the youngest of 13 children. The runt of the litter, you might say, but he left a big impression. Growing up on the west side of Indianapolis, he began firing basketballs at a wooden backboard attached to a telephone pole. He developed this game at the boys' clubs and then became a star at Washington High School. Even back then, not every school wanted a 5'8 guard, but Butler's Tony Hinkle did. He became the conference MVP for two seasons, received All-American recognition, and was one of the nation's leading scorers thanks to his deadly two-handed set shot. He went on to play in the NBA, the last Butler grad to do that until Gordon Hayward came along, and then settled into a life in the real world. He sold insurance, worked as a television analyst for college basketball games for a while, and left another legacy with his daughter, who was an Indiana All-Star and LPGA Rookie of the Year. But perhaps his most lasting accomplishment was to help start youth basketball programs in the city that still go on today. He's got memories and stories, so let's get on it. I'm Mark Monteith, and I'm going one-on-one with Ralph Buckshot O'Brien.
This is One-on-One with Mark Monteith on 1070 The Fan. Brought to you by Georgetown Market, Indy's family-owned natural food store since 1973. Movie Time Video Productions, they make your memories last forever.
Well, today, One-on-One comes to you over the phone lines all the way to Clearwater Beach, Florida. We're going to talk with a local legend. This is a man with great stories to tell and a lot of history in Indiana sports, and none other than Buckshot O'Brien, former All-American at Butler University, professional player, and made a mark in other fields as well. So, Buckshot, I appreciate you spending the time with us. I guess the first thing we should do is clear up the obvious question, and that is, how does a man get the nickname Buckshot?
Well, that's pretty easy to tell you. I was the baby of 13, and I had eight brothers and four sisters. And I think when I was born, my dad, fortunately, I don't know, I was the runt of the litter. So we had a grocery store keeper named Otto Dickerson that we went to pretty regular. And out of the clear blue sky, when I was about 3 years old or four, he said, "You're never going to be any bigger than a buckshot."
Okay.
And so that little nickname just stuck. And it stuck through grade school, through high school, through college, and professional ball. It's probably one of the best nicknames I could have ever had.
I've never heard of anybody else with the nickname Buckshot. So you've got something unique there.
Lindsey Nelson, who did the announcing for the Knicks games, he called me Sure Shot Buckshot.
Sure Shot Buckshot.
That was a compliment all by itself.
Sure, absolutely. So one of 13 kids, and you grew up on the near West Side, right? Because you went to Washington High School.
I grew up on the West Side of Indianapolis. I lived at 1140 West New York Street.
1140 West New York. What is it like growing up one of 13 children?
Well, it's pretty fun. You don't have to worry about anybody that you're going to play with or anything like that, you know. And I had, I had four brothers in front of me that all played ball in front of me in grade school, high school, and everything else. The age spades is about 4 years. The twins were very good high school players. Then the service came along during that time. It was the war. And while I was playing in high school, they were fighting for our country in World War II. And my older brother, Pete, went to the University of Miami of Ohio. And when the twins came back from service, we all went to school at Butler together. We all played on the same team. And then my older brother, Roger, before the war broke out, he signed a baseball contract with the St. Louis Browns. And before he could go to spring training, he was drafted and had to go into service, so he went to the Navy. And then he made a career out of the Navy.
Yeah. Wow. So what did your dad do to support such a large family?
Well, he just worked two jobs. And he worked at the cotton mill and was a foreman there, and then he tinned bar at night.
Mm. So you didn't see a lot of him, did you?
Well, yes and no, you know. I used to help him on the weekends close up close up the place or help clean it up before they opened it, you know, because he'd work on weekends there. And then the greatest thing was when he left all of that, he got a custodial job at the Indiana Dental and Medical School. And when I was playing at Butler, all the doctors, the half of them that went to Indiana University, and see, we played them in the Hoosier Classic when I was in school.
Right.
They always wanted to bet my dad, you know. And I used to tell my dad, hey, take whatever they want, Dad. I'm going to tell you, because we got a pretty good ball club here, and I think we can handle them. And so, of course, I never lost to Indiana until my senior year.
So your dad made some money on those bets,
yeah,
huh?
Yeah, he did, yeah. And he had a lot of laughs. My dad never saw me play basketball until I was a sophomore at Butler. He didn't have time, you know, to get to do those things.
Oh, wow. So all through your high school career at Washington,
right.
He wasn't able to see you play.
It was my mom that was almost at every game.
Yeah, because your dad was bartending.
Well, yeah, he was working, trying to keep the stuff on the table.
Yeah. How big was your house?
Well, we had one, two, three. Every room was a bedroom except the kitchen.
Okay.
When you got that many. Well, we had one, two, three. We had three bedrooms upstairs. Slept two in there, and Mom and Dad and them, they slept in the front room all the time.
Mm.
And it was amazing how we used to have to come in. You know, if we were out late, they knew every kid. They knew every time you were in and out. And
because you walked right into their bedroom, didn't you?
Yeah, that's right. Walked through. You know, try to slip in, go through, but. It was neat. So we finally decided to climb the tree up the roof and leave the front window open so that they wouldn't know any time we got in.
You'd sneak in through the window.
Yeah, and that worked pretty well until one night one of the twins was coming in and the officer happened to be patrolling the neighborhood and he saw the kid climbing from one tree to the roof. And so he put the spotlight on him and asked him to come down.
Got caught in the act.
And got caught in the act. So that ended our route into the window from there, you know.
How many bathrooms in this house?
Well, we had two.
Two bathrooms for 15 people, huh?
That's right.
How do you manage that?
Pretty easy. You just had to wait and be patient.
Yeah, I imagine. I hope if the plumbing ever went out, you were in big trouble.
Well, see, not of that, but back in those days, you know, just think about your mother, who had those washing machines with the wringer and the scrubbing board at that time. This wasn't like what you got today, you know. It was a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah, there's always activity. You're never bored, I'm sure.
We used to make homemade ice cream. We had a 2.5-gallon freezer, and we used to use that Christ ice and crank it with the salt and everything. Then we had more than just in our household. We had all the neighbors used to want to stop by and have a little of the banana ice cream we'd make or the peach ice cream. And Mom was always a free willer, and anybody stop by, you can do it, you know. And it was neat. It really was. The big family's fun.
So you're 85 now, is that right?
Yes, getting closer to 86.
How many of your siblings are still with us?
You mean my and my family?
Yeah, you're... Brothers and sisters.
I'm the only survivor.
Only one left. Okay.
Yes.
Wow. Well, that's a great childhood right there. So how do you get introduced to basketball?
Oh, how did I get introduced
to
it? Well, that was pretty easy because the boys' club was only about two or three blocks from my grade school, and my older brothers were going to the club, so I started going, and you couldn't go until you were 5 or 6 years old, so... I started going with my older brothers to the club, and I played on my first organized team when I was 6. We couldn't get it to the basket, but at least we played. They didn't go and lower the baskets then.
Yeah.
In those days, and so it was fun. And then Everett Kelly at the boys' club, who was like another father to all of us, and I ended up really working in the summer with the boys' clubs in high school, and then assistant director when I was in college. It was just part of my life, along with school and basketball. And I used to practice at Butler and then go scrimmage with Kelly. He'd pick and play 2-on-2. I shouldn't be doing this. Hinkle would have killed me if he had known that would have been happening. But I used to go in because it was the gym. We had the gym. We had the game room and everything else. And I worked every night until I got home around 10. The club was open from 7 to 9, and I'd get back home between 9:30 and 10. But shoot buckets. I mean, that was the name of the game.
Yeah. So you're playing at the boys' club, and I would imagine as a kid growing up, your only ambition probably was to be a good high school player, huh? You're not thinking about professional basketball.
Well, I had not even in my mind. I just wanted to make sure to follow my brothers, who all played high school ball in front of me. And it was just try to get better as you can, you know?
Yeah.
And so I used to play with my peers, and then my brothers used to kill me out in our backyard when we had our court out on the dirt and our backboard was on a telephone pole, and we could play back there. I was the last one chosen in the neighborhood games, and then they would throw it to me and say, throw it right back, you know?
Yeah, don't shoot. But that probably was a good thing for you, right?
Yes, it was. It just made you want a little harder and play a little and work a little harder. Really, that is the truth.
Now, you were known as a high-scoring guard in your era. How did you score? Were you shooting two-handed set shots?
I could go either way. I had a good one-hand runner. I could drive, and I could hit from the outside.
Yeah, how far out would you shoot?
25, 30 feet.
25 to 30 feet. That was kind of the norm back then, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Well, Brian's too small to play at Miami of Ohio, but not to play at Butler when One-on-One continues. Back on One-on-One, Mark Monteith here with former Butler star Ralph Buckshot O'Brien. After leaving Washington High School in 1946, he defied the doubters and went to Butler. And like everyone else who played for Tony Hinkle, he's got some stories. You played at Washington High School.
Uh-huh, yes, sir.
And you graduated from there in 1946.
46.
So when you're in high school, you're playing in like a 16-team sectional at Butler. This is when Indiana high school basketball, you know, is just, you know, obviously the thing. What was it like playing in a 16-team sectional, all those schools?
Well, it was real interesting because you got out of school all day on Friday, especially when they played the sectionals, because they started on Wednesday. Then on Friday, they played Friday morning, Friday afternoon, and then Friday night. And then you had your Saturday, which is finals. You play in the afternoon, and you play the finals at night. We got to the semifinals, but we never got to the finals.
Right, because you're talking about all the city schools and some of the outlying areas.
County
too.
Schools, city schools, right. And that's where the sectional was held.
Wow. Well, that was a big deal, obviously, just to win a sectional back then.
Oh, well, not only that, but when I was a Butler, which was great that after high school, my job was keeping the Butler floor because they had what you call the tuition job scholarship. So my job was to keep the floor clean.
Uh-huh.
So when they had the city tournaments and the sectionals and the regionals, the semifinals, and the state, I had the best seat in the house, and I got to clean the floor, and they paid me $15 a session. And back there then, that was big money.
Absolutely.
It was paid by the IHSAA, you know, the NF High School Association. So I used to smile when the tournament come about.
A lot of money. So were you on a scholarship, though? I mean, were your tuition books paid for?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Yes. Now, were you recruited? Did you visit?
Oh, no. I was recruited at Butler. That's very rare. Bob Dietz was probably, he was the assistant coach at Butler University during the years I was there. And Bob ended up being a very good friend of mine. And, I was playing down at the YMCA when he was playing with the Indianapolis Koskies, which was the pro team in the National Basketball League, because he was coaching there and playing pro ball with the Koskies. those guys would practice, and I used to practice and play with them at the YMCA on cross court.
Mm-hmm.
And then he knew from high school, because he went to Indianapolis, Washington also. He was a graduate from there.
Mm-hmm.
And so he and Mr. Hinkle, they came out, and I said, fine, I'd be glad to, because I went to the Miami of Ohio, and he told me that I was too small, I could never have played for him.
Mm.
And that's where my brother played. So this ended up being a real thing, because when we were in the Mid-American Conference playing at Butler, we played Miami 8 times. We played them twice a year in the Mid-American Conference, and we beat them 8 straight times. And I was fortunate to be the MVP in the Mid-American Conference my junior and senior year. And I'd go up to Mr. Foster, and I'd ask him every time after the game, do you remember me?
What'd he say?
So my junior year, he said, Buck, can't you let a dead dog die? So we laughed about it from there on out. I said, well, we only got 3 more to go, but I just want you to remember, because I don't want you to make that mistake again. Don't ever tell somebody they're too small.
Right. You were 5'9", is that right?
Well, I really was only 5'8". The reason I put that 5'9" down was because I started getting letters from pro teams when I was a junior, and I didn't think they'd look too much at 5'8" and 140 pounds, so I put my height down at 5'9" and 150.
Well, that was at Butler, right? You listed yourself.
Yeah, that's when I was at Butler. That's true.
But you're actually 5'8", 140
in
college. How about that? Did Indiana or Purdue show interest in you out of high school?
Well, Brant also was one that thought I was too small to play, which is okay, you know. That's the whole deal from the time from grade school. I was only 4'8" and weighed 84 pounds when I entered high school. Mm-hmm. I'm the only guy that sat in front with the girls to have the picture taken.
Because you were so small.
That's right.
Wow. And you probably got teased a lot, and your older brothers were telling you not to shoot. So you always had something to prove, and probably kind of a chip on your shoulder, huh?
Well, I wouldn't say it was a chip. It's just something that just inside you says, look, I'll prove it to them, you know.
Yeah. So at Butler, you were able to be a 4-year starter, right? Was that
right.
Because of the war?
No, I don't think it was because of the war. No, that was after the war. See, all of them came back from the service.
Right, right. But I'm trying to remember, you know, freshmen were not eligible throughout.
Well, they were during that time.
Okay.
When I enrolled, that's one reason why it was great to get that break.
Yeah.
Because up until then, freshmen had to lay out the first year, you know, and you played what a freshman schedule or what they call a reserve schedule or something like that.
But you got to play varsity 4 years, and you averaged 9 points as a freshman, then 12, then 16, then as a senior, 18.3, which was a lot in that era.
True.
You were the 20th leading scorer in the country your senior year at Butler. You were top 20 in free throw percentage. So you're even despite your size, you know, your shooting ability and your quickness allowed you to get it done. What was it like playing for Tony Hinkle, particularly then? I mean, I talked to guys who played for him at the end of his coaching career, and they have stories, but that's at the end. What was it like playing for a young Tony Hinkle?
Oh, he was incredible. He used to have shooting contests with us on his bank shots. I never shot banks unless it was a lay-in. I always like to hear the net sing, you know.
Uh-huh.
But he used to shoot us for our free tickets. He'd even shoot free throws. You know, we'd have so many tickets that we could get, you know, for the parents and the family to come to the games. And if he beat you, he kept the tickets.
So you'd have to bank every shot, huh?
Oh, but he would bank it from the side. He would make you little side wagers. You know, I can shoot over here, because Hank was a good athlete.
Yeah.
You know, and a great person. I became very, very close to him after we got out of school. In school, he was so funny. I don't know if you know the story of what he pulled on me when I was a junior.
No.
He brought a guy in that he thought maybe that my head, and I was getting to thinking I was better than I really was or something like that. Anyway, he brought a guy in with 14 million cameras and Zoom things, and I was late coming in from a lab that I had that afternoon late at practice, and I was only going to get there in time to scrimmage. So I came in, got on the floor, and he called me over, and he said, "Now, this gentleman here is from one of the magazines, and he's looking at you. He wants to see, he wants to take some film and pictures, as he is a potential All-American this year on the pickings, you know, like Look Magazine and the other things that are coming about." And I said, "Well, that, you know, that's nice." He said, "Well, just go down there and warm up a little bit on the side, and then we'll throw you in the scrimmage." But in the meantime, he told all of the guys on the team to not give me the ball. Give me the California fake. Uh-huh. Have me cut, pass. And then for 15 minutes, I never touched the basketball. I finally stole the ball, went down and laid it in. I went over to him, and I said, "You tell that guy down there, if he wants to get pictures of me, he better come another day, because I've either got some disease or there's something happened." And I knew when Jimmy gave me that, I was so wide open, and he gave me that California fake and kept the ball and threw it back and snickered. I knew that I'd been had, you know.
Yeah.
But I didn't know why. So when it was all over, Hingle said, "Come over here." He said, "This is my brother-in-law, and he's a bird man. He was here to take pictures of birds and things that are in our trees by the canal and the patch and everything else." So I had a big laugh. Everybody had a big laugh. It was fun.
Yeah, that's interesting. So you always hear about his sense of humor. I guess later years he didn't seem to remember anybody's name and just called them by their high school.
No, either that or kid.
Yeah.
And we'd make wagers. You'd see you, and he'd say, "Hi, kid. How you doing, kid?" He wouldn't say, "Hi, Buck," or "Hi, Jim."
Yeah.
No, that was typical. "Hey, kiddo, come here, kiddo." We'd say, even if we're out in a restaurant, and then he's coming, it's, "Hi, kid, how you doing?" But it was neat. And, you know, how many men, Johnny Wooden, Mr. Wooden, that I knew when he coached South Bend Central High School, and then I played against him when he coached at Indiana State.
Mm-hmm.
He was coaching Indiana State when I was playing at Butler. He said that Coach Hinkle was probably the greatest coach that ever coached, period. And, well, why wouldn't it be when you think of here is an individual that coached football, baseball, and basketball and was athletic director at the same school for 46 years?
Yeah.
Now, Mark, that's totally incredible.
He always seemed pretty calm on the sidelines. When I went to games in the 60s, you know, he'd just sit over there cross-legged and watch the game, and he'd get up to say things to the officials and so forth, but he always seemed fairly calm from what I remember.
Well, that's why the officials respected him. But he wasn't calm inside. We played at Michigan, and we got sick on the plane flying in there up and down and everything else. And, I mean, we looked so bad the first half that he made us introduce ourselves to each other at the half.
In the locker room, huh?
In the locker room. We had to go around. So we come out the second half, and I almost pulled the ball game out. But it was just awful.
Yeah.
But when we had to introduce ourselves, I thought that was neat, you know.
Kind of lighten the mood?
Yeah, it sure did.
What did he do when he got really mad? Say if you guys had played a poor game or had
he
a
would
bad
never,
practice?
Nothing about life. No, he would never say anything, no.
Yeah.
No. Never browbeat you. I remember the only thing, when I got tripped up in my nose, I fell down on that Butler floor, hit it, and smashed my nose, and blood was everywhere. And I'm laying down there, and he says, "Do you know how much it would cost us if we have to fix that floor where it was splintered with your nose?"
Yeah. Yeah, I've heard the ones how if somebody would trip over their own feet in practice, he'd go lay down on the floor and look at the paint on the line and say, "Yeah, I can see how you could trip over that line," you know, that type of thing.
Yeah, that was him. That was Hank.
It is. Oh, yeah. Were his practices demanding? I mean, did you run a lot, or what were his practices like?
Oh, yeah, we ran a lot. We'd work on basics. We'd work on fundamentals, and then we would scrimmage. And we were in shape, I'll put it this way. You better be in shape, or your legs and body wouldn't hold up there. He wasn't severe, you know. He wasn't a yeller. Even though he would get upset, he would always have an example to show you of why you shouldn't be doing this.
probably the best team you played on at Butler was the 48-49 team your junior year. You finished 18-5. You won the Hoosier Classic, beating both IU and Purdue, and you also beat Notre Dame during the regular season.
Right.
And I believe you were ranked as high as 11th in the country.
That is correct.
But what you didn't make the NCAA tournament that year. What
we
happened?
Should have, that year we really should have finished about 21-2. The only reason, see, you got to remember back there then, though, the big tournament was the NIT.
Right. Bigger than the NCAA, right.
And we had the bid to the NIT. Somewhere between the university and Coach Hinkle, we didn't go because we lost to Western Reserve on our last ball game that made us 18-5. We lost two ball games we should and could have won. But 18-5 is still good with the schedule that we played.
O'Brien turns pro when One-on-One continues. Welcome back to One-on-One. Mark Monteith here with former Butler star Buckshot O'Brien. He played a season in the National Professional Basketball League after graduating from Butler and then joined the ill-fated Indianapolis Olympians of the NBA. His NBA career was brief, but he did get the chance to get paid for playing the game. So you come out of Butler in 1950, and you're listed as a sixth-round draft pick of the Olympians, the local NBA team. The Olympians were a charter member of the NBA. And I'm curious, you know, how do you find out that you've been drafted by the Olympians? I mean, it's not like the NBA draft was televised in 1950. How does that all come about?
Well, the thing about it is, at that time, you got to remember, back there then with the teams that were playing, the Olympics were playing, you had teams like the Anderson Packers, Sheboygan Redskins, Oshkosh,
right.
Waterloo. Then you had Milwaukee. You had Rochester Royals. You had Syracuse Nationals. You had the Washington Capitals. You had the Boston Celtics. I'm just trying to, you know, go back with all the teams that were there before they changed towns here later on. And then this is when I was in 1951. See, I played in what they called the National Basketball League, and I played my first year because I turned down the offer from the Olympians.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
because I was really drafted by Fort Wayne, and they traded me back to the Olymps.
Okay.
I would have gone immediately had it been Fort Wayne, because I thought at that time with the Olympians, with all of the guards and everything that they had, with Ralph Beard and with Walther and all the others, you know, I just didn't anticipate on the basis. I'd love to have stayed home, but the amount of money that they offered was ridiculous. And where do you think they left my offer sheet?
Where?
In the training room at Butler University.
They just left an offer sheet for you in the training room, huh?
That's right.
Because they practiced and played at Butler themselves.
Yes, uh-huh.
And how much was that offer for?
For $4,500.
$4,500, okay. And that was, I mean, there were no doubt other players making that amount of money then.
Oh, but, yes, I know. I understand that. But I was disappointed in the fact that they couldn't meet or call me and give me the thing instead of leave it there for everybody and their uncle.
Right. In that 50-51 season, you played where?
In 1950 to 51, I played with the Waterloo Hawks. And in that league where I was Rookie of the Year and averaged 15.1 points a ball game. Then I came home, and I decided that I was just going to go into coaching. So I took the job at Broderpo High School in Indianapolis. Then the Olymps approached me. because that's when the gambling scandal happened.
Right.
And they approached me to come because they didn't know what problems they were going to have. So they offered me $5,250, which is almost $1,000 more than, you know, before anyway. But back then, that really wasn't bad money because college coaches were only making $5,000, $5,600 a year. $6,000 a year job was a good job if he's in college.
Right.
But the funny thing was, I started practicing with him, and you know, after my school duties, and then they got to like it a little more and more, and then this scandal was breaking out more and more and more, and so then what really happened was I replaced Bruce Hale, who was a good, I remember him from watching him play all the years when he played with the Koskies and in the years before. And I felt bad about it, but they cut him. They offered me the contract, and so I resigned. I resigned from coaching at Broad Ripple and went in and played with the Olymps. And then we lost Alex, and we lost Ralph. And then our guards were Tasha, Walter, and myself. And I enjoyed it very much because I was playing at home and on the same floor that I knew.
Yeah, and just a quick summary, you know, the Olympians originally were made up of the University of Kentucky team that had won national championships in the late 40s, and then they were player owners of this franchise in the NBA in Indianapolis, and then, though, going into the, I guess, third year of the league, of the franchise, it was discovered that a couple players had taken money. There's like basically a point shaving scandal going
that's
back to their
exactly,
days at Kentucky.
Yes, Mark, that's exactly what it was.
And Ralph Beard and Alex Groza are banned for life from
right.
the NBA.
And, I remember when Ralph, we worked together in junior baseball in the summertime, and I remember Ralph coming to me and saying, what do you think about this? This is before this really, all this happened, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, Ralph, my opinion is that anybody that is thinking about anything else about except playing the ball game, you're not only cheating your team, you're cheating yourself and you're cheating your fans. And I don't care whether you're shaving points or whether you're going above or below, you just can't do that because You're really a total cheater. And if I was in school and some guy took money and shaved points and we lost a ball game or couldn't go to the national championship, I would really be upset. And I didn't know this was going to happen.
Yeah.
To this day, I felt bad about it, but I told him the truth.
Right. Yeah. He was starting to feel the heat, no doubt.
Investigation. That's what I didn't put it together, you know, at that time.
Yeah. Well, your time with the Olympians, you know, the first year went well. I mean, you averaged something like 9 points
a
game.
The second year, I don't know what happened with Coach Schaefer. Evidently, he got us something, a call up about my situation, and don't ask me why, because I really don't know to this day. I don't know. And sometimes that can happen. I was the same player. Nothing had changed, you know. And I was really thankful that I finally got traded.
Well, Brian retires from pro basketball and enters the real world. And for him, it turns out to be a really good one, thanks in part to his name recognition. And One-on-One continues. Back on One-on-One, I'm Mark Monteith, and I'm talking this time with former Butler star Buckshot O'Brien. He was traded to the Fort Wayne Pistons during his second season with the Indianapolis Olympians. He only lasted 7 games there, and then was traded to the Baltimore Bullets, where he finished the season and got a chance to compete in the playoffs. He retired from pro basketball at that point and returned to Indianapolis. And from then on, he left a mark in the insurance world, on television, and with his daughter, with whom he shares a unique achievement.
So you're done with basketball in 1953, and you move back to Indianapolis then?
Yes.
Okay. And go into insurance?
Yes.
Yeah, and you have a big name, so that had to help. I mean, it probably was an enjoyable and lucrative occupation for you, being Buckshot O'Brien selling insurance in Indianapolis, huh?
Well, it didn't hurt me, I'll put it this way. It gave me a pretty good entree, and yeah. I made and talked to a lot of friends and helped out a lot of people. Because I had 45 years of very, very, very good success.
Yeah, and but you also get into television, radio and television broadcasting.
In 62, yes, with WLWI, with Charlie Brockman.
Right.
And I had my little buckboard. I used to draw all the defenses. I can tell you a great story. I was never supposed to do a commercial, okay? So we had Emgee hot dogs, you know, Emgee meats. And we had Hoosier Coal and Oil, and we had, I think, Pepsi-Cola or whoever was doing the sponsoring. So that night they decided that I'm going to help do this hot dog commercial, right? So that bun and that hot dog, that was the hardest bun I've ever seen in my life. I was supposed to taste it and tell them, you know, how good it was. I bit into that bun, and the whole thing shattered, and all I had left in my mouth was that hot dog. And here it was on. Here it was on national TV. You
live
know?
TV, yeah.
Yeah, and when I say national, I'm talking about going throughout the state of, you know, of Indiana. You know.
Yeah.
And I said, well, you know, the hot dog is good, but I don't know about the bun. And I said what I was really supposed to say, because in the meantime, the guy with the cue card, I said he's in the third row, going up the fourth aisle, right there, with what I was supposed to tell you. So Charlie Brockman jumped in right quick and bailed me out. It was really funny.
Yeah.
And then you're talking about strange people and basketball fans. Mm-hmm. We were doing the Indiana-Michigan game when Michigan was rated number one in the country. And Indiana had the Van Arsdale twins, and they had a good ball club. And Indiana had Michigan down 7 points with 59 seconds to go in the ball game.
Mm-hmm.
And the student body started shouting, "We're number one. We're number one." And I said to Charlie, I said, "I wouldn't be saying that if I was them." I said, "There's too much time left." And Charles said to me real quick, like, "Well, what could happen?" I mean, right on the spot. And I said, "Well, a bad pass and an interception, you know." And I no sooner got those words out of my mouth, and they intercepted the inbounds pass and laid it in and got fouled. Okay, so now it's a 5-point lead with 57 seconds to go. So the guy goes to the free throw line, right? He shoots a free throw and he misses it, got the rebound and laid it in and got fouled. Now a 2-point lead with 54 seconds to go. Well, anyway, they went in overtime and they got beat, okay?
Yep.
So at 3-something in the morning, because I can't keep my phone number from somebody knowing it from the office or home or anything else. And at 3:30 in the morning, a phone call and a little gruff little voice says, "Is Beck Shadow Brian there?" And I said, "You got him." And he says, "Well, I'm just calling to tell you that us Hoosiers are sick and tired of you and your predictions."
That game is historic. I mean, I have a vague memory of watching it as a kid, and I've talked to Tom Van Arsdale about it. It's a game that he remembers very well. I mean, it's still painful all these years later.
Well, I can understand that. And so I said to him, "Well, sir," I said, "I don't remember taking a ball out of bounds, and I don't remember throwing a bad pass. I don't remember fouling anybody." And he said, "That's exactly what I'm talking about." He said, you know, and then he went into a few other. I said, "Well, I just really want to thank you for calling. I'm glad you enjoyed the game." So I hang the phone up, and my wife says, "Who is that?" And I said, "That's just another basketball fan that loves me."
Oh, it's a shame that nobody has a copy of that broadcast, isn't it? I mean, that'd be great.
Oh, it
to
is. It really is. That is incredible.
So you did, was it just IU games that you and Charlie?
No, I did Indiana, Purdue, Butler, and anyone on that stage. Yeah. At those particular times of the games that they pick to choose, you know.
Okay. Okay. Like, how many games a year would you be doing?
I would say 16.
Okay.
I would have done it for nothing because the exposure, as far as my business and everything else.
Yeah. Kept your name alive.
I used to tell them, all of them, be careful going home, and if you don't have insurance, you know who to call.
You were the last Butler player to play in the NBA until Gordon Hayward came along all those years later.
And, yes, that's true.
And that had to be a thrill for you watching Butler make those consecutive runs to the championship game of the tournament.
I was right there.
I know you came back for it, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
Did you go to the one in Indianapolis, right? Did you go to both of them or just the one here?
No, I just went to the one in Indianapolis, and it was great.
And your daughter Kyle was an All-State basketball player at North Central.
Yes, he was.
And went to Southern Methodist and was an All-American golfer there.
She won the NCAA.
Right.
She won the National Collegiate Golf Championship, and she was Rookie of the Year on the LPGA Tour in 1980.
1981 is what I read.
80 or 81. Yeah, because she graduated in 80. It was in 81. Right.
LPGA Rookie of the Year in 1981, the medalist on a national championship golf team. You and Kyle, are the only father-daughter combination to be in the state basketball Hall of Fame.
In the state in Indiana, yes.
Yeah, so that's quite a distinction there. You know, when you were growing up, girls were not playing basketball. Were you at all hesitant to, you know, allow her to get into playing basketball? Or?
Heavens no. I thought it was great. I thought it'd be great for her because, see, that's just when the girls just started to come along and move along. And Kyle was a very, very good player. She was a good shooter. And she was on the first girls Indiana All-Star team.
Right, the very first one, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah. In fact, when I was at the ball game, when she hit those shots from the outside, I had several people say, "Well, she's a better shooter than you were." I said, "You know why? She's had good coaching."
Did you work with her a lot?
Oh, yes. Oh, are you kidding me? Sure did. I taught her how to drive the baseline because I said most girls would give up on you. She go either way, dribble with her hand, hit from the outside. It was fun.
Yeah.
It's really fun. There's no greater thrill than watching your siblings do something worthwhile.
Yeah, your children, you mean, yeah.
Yes.
Well, you know, looking back, growing up one of 13 kids, you obviously learn how to get along with people and work with people and do whatever's necessary to make something happen, you know, to compromise here and there, that type of thing. It had to be a great asset to you.
One thing about it, you do learn how to share. The only thing in our household, whoever's first up was best dressed.
They grabbed the clothes, huh?
That's right.
So you got up early?
Well, like the ties and everything, if you had to wear them, man. It was just, who got that? Well, I saw a twin just go out with one of them, you know. But if they were all about the same size, it was whoever's best up was the best dress right then.
Now, you're the youngest and the smallest, though, so there couldn't have been too many.
Well, I had the best hand-me-downs because my mom was a good seamstress.
Okay.
No. When I got something new, it was later on. In fact, even when I was in college, Dave Yaver, who had Yaver's Men's Shop up there on Pennsylvania, and I think it was Pennsylvania and either Illinois Street or Ohio Street, Pennsylvania and Ohio, every time he changed his wardrobe, I was his same size. They thought I had inherited a lot of money because I was one of the best-dressed kids at Butler.
He was giving you clothes.
He gave me the clothes, you know. It was incredible.
One-on-One with Buckshot O'Brien continues in a moment. You can't. Hey, thanks to Ralph O'Brien for donating his time to the one-on-one cause. You know, he just might be the only man in the world nicknamed Buckshot. Nothing wrong with that. He's got a unique name and a unique life as well. Growing up as one of 13 kids and having the basketball career and post-basketball career that he's had. I visited with him in his home in Clearwater, Florida a few years ago, and he was as nice then as he was on the telephone this time. He still follows Butler awfully closely and ranks as one of the most veteran former Bulldog players on the planet. Now, if you missed part of this conversation or have a burning desire to hear one of the others in the one-on-one library, all you got to do is go to 1070thefan.com. Click on shows, click on one-on-one, and all the podcasts are there for your listening pleasure. My email address is mark@1070thefan.com, and I'm available on Facebook and Twitter, with the Twitter handle being @MarkMonteith. I'll be back again next week with yet another spine-tingling conversation with an Indiana sports personality, right here on FM 107.5 and 1070 The Fan.